G'day and welcome to another episode of the Luke's Lowdown podcast. Today, I have Claire Smith, aka Brutal Claire. She's an ultra endurance athlete, race director of Brutal Events, which is where we actually connected many years ago, but more on that later. A speaker, a published author, and also a mum of two. Many of you may have heard of Brutal Claire, and today we're going to dive into where that name came from and what makes her tick. She has created and taken on and completed some of, in my opinion, the most extreme challenges out there. And that's saying something, I think. Everyone, let me introduce you to the lovely Claire Smith. Claire, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. So, as I mentioned, your nickname is Brutal Claire.
Yeah.
And as I also just said in the intro, that there's an event company called Brutal Events that you founded and ran now. And your book that was published in 2021 has had a lot of great reviews, and I've read plenty of them, is also called Becoming Brutal.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to know is why that title?
Okay, well, I didn't like name myself Brutal Claire. The guy who was the winner of the first ever Double Brutal, Matty Dales, who is now one of my closest friends, he actually named me Brutal Claire because he gives nicknames to all his friends. That's just what he does. So I became Brutal Claire based on that, based on me running Brutal Events, not so much me being brutal. So it kind of grew from there, and I kind of grew into Brutal Claire, if you like, from that, and took on more and more challenging events and became known for being brutal, if you like, as well as running Brutal Events. And I guess the book was that story from, you know, becoming a stronger endurance athlete, a stronger person mentally and physically over the years.
Yeah, that makes sense. It just continued on with the brand, and I love the way that you said you grew into the name, and not intentionally, by all means.
Authentically, yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, you wrote in your book, and Becoming Brutal, which is available on Amazon now, very openly and honestly about, you know, the past struggles and battles that you've had with abusive relationships and alcohol addiction and things like that. Do you feel like this had anything to do with choosing the path that you've chosen to go down in terms of these extreme challenges?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, for me, recognizing that I've got a massively addictive personality very early on, to be honest, even before I properly sort of started recovering, I knew that I needed to find something else. Like I said, like a healthier addiction, if you like. There was no point in acknowledging that I've got an addictive personality and then trying just to give up alcohol, give up whatever else I was doing without trying to replace it. Unfortunately, you do have to find some sort of replacement, I find.
Okay. I've met a hell of a lot of, and I'm going to say ultra endurance athletes, and yeah, you're definitely one of those people. And they're the people that look at, say, an Ironman triathlon not as a race, but as a bit of a training day. You know what I mean? Like, that's not to be disrespectful to people who race or just go out to complete Ironman triathlons. It's a very different beast. If you and I went to do an Ironman triathlon and said, okay, the target today is to go as fast as we can, no doubt we both would go, that is horrible, I'm not interested in that. But if someone said, okay, just go out and just complete it and do it, that's a fun day out. So
it's training.
There is context to that. So ultra endurance athletes, for the point of this conversation, are the ones that like to go a bit longer than what's deemed as just normally crazy, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the ones that I've met and had conversations with, and I put myself into this category as well, I find they're doing one or two things. And sometimes they can be doing both over a period of time. Ultra endurance athletes, in my experience, are running away from something or chasing after something. Where do you fit into these statements right now, where you are in 2022 when we're recording this.
Yeah, I mean, definitely running towards something good. No, I don't run from the past anymore. I don't struggle massively with anything like that. I'm looking to improve myself. I recognize my weaknesses now. It's for, so like for challenges that I'm taking on later this year, with swimming, sea swimming specifically, you know, that's a huge weakness for me. And in order to complete what I need to do, I have to do an awful lot of, you know, training, doing some really unpleasant things that I don't want to do. So I'm definitely running towards that, right? That's my focus right now. I'm not dwelling on the past or anything like that. I'm not running away from things right now.
So am I right to say that, and, you know, I'm trying to read between the lines here, and although in your book it's pretty transparent, but you were running away from something initially as you got into ultra endurance sports?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, God, I was running away basically from, you know, alcohol issues that I'd had from my, you know, late teens, to be honest. I knew very early, I think I was about 18 when I realized that I had a problem with alcohol, and it was just a thought. And I remember it, you know, as clear as day. I remember I was looking out of my window. I lived in a flat in not particularly nice place at the time. And I just remember thinking, I don't have a healthy relationship with alcohol. And to know that at 18 and to continue, you know, with that unhealthy addiction for, oh my goodness, till I was 38, I think. I'm quite determined to make things work, you know. that's a long time to fight something and to try and continue with it. So I was definitely using it, for sure.
So what changed from within you, an experience from you acknowledging that you're running away from something to chasing after something good, to use your words?
What changed? As in, what do you mean, what?
So how did you go from running away from something to now running towards something good?
Okay, well, I guess it's just time. It's just, you know, it's taken me time to break, you know, that addictive lifestyle, a very destructive lifestyle that I used to live. It used to take up so much of my time. It was exhausting trying to lead this awful double life. So, you know, that, and to stop what I was doing and to move into where I am now, it wasn't an overnight thing. It took years and years of changing my life, changing my mindset, changing all these habits that I just had for so long. Negative self-talk, you know, whenever something stressful happened or I had to like deal with something, even day-to-day stuff, I would be like, I need a drink. And it was like breaking that habit was incredibly difficult, and it certainly wasn't a quick process, and I underestimated it massively. It took years, and to now, nearly, I think, 9 years, you know, it's not something I deal with on a day-to-day basis. I'm very careful. I'm not blasé. And it does affect me still occasionally when stressful, really stressful things happen. But, you know, most of the time now, I'm just like dealing with the business, dealing with my events. You know, I'm focused on moving forward and being healthier and just living a better life.
If there's someone listening to this podcast right now who has acknowledged they're running away from something, and it could be their own version of their own story, right? Running away from whatever it is they're running away from, or maybe they're not even conscious that they are running away from something, but they are stuck in a bit of a rut, and they maybe want to shift their focus, change their life, and look to running towards or moving towards something. From your own experience, what would be a couple of just thoughts, ideas, tips, whatever it is, what advice would you give the listener who's listening to this, who is sick and tired of running away from something and wants to start lifting up their chin and looking towards the future?
I think one of the things I do is I quite often think, what would my life look like, my ideal life look like, you know, in a year or 5 years? I think that's quite a good exercise, and just literally sit down and write, and don't know, you know, you don't have to worry about anyone judging you, and maybe your ideas are crazy, and just start at that very basic level of what would I, you know, if I had the choice right now, how could I change things? And then from that, work backwards. Okay, so I want to do this, how can I achieve it? I want to lose weight, how can I achieve that? And then breaking things down, that's another thing. I mean, I'm writing another book right now, and it's really hard writing a book. And as you know, it is, and I'm like, I'm getting stuck on it again, and I'm starting to struggle, and it's just like, okay, right, how many words do I need to write this week? Okay, so break that down. How many words do I need to write a day? And all of a sudden it becomes achievable. And then before you know it, you're kind of halfway through and you're like, okay, I'm writing a book now. So it's breaking things down massively, but also visualizing, you know, what do you want in the future, and then working backwards from that.
It's a great thing to take away. And I think a lot of people get stuck on the big picture, the finishing line. And,
overwhelming,
Yeah, because you look at writing a book and you see these X amount of words on a page all bundled up nicely with a cover photo and a blurb on the back. And,
yeah.
I could never do that. But in reality, and, you know, this is going to be a great segue into some of your adventure challenges, it's not about looking at what you have to do from a bigger picture. It's looking at what you need to do right now in this moment to set yourself up, to give yourself a chance to achieve what it is you want to achieve in the future.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to say this is pretty much, this runs through your entire life. What was the first endurance challenge that you did? And what was your immediate thoughts once you completed it?
The first thing that I properly did, I suppose that you could say was endurance, was my first Ironman. It was in Sherborne at the time. And I was going through, I just separated from my husband. I was going through a really, really rough time. I was drinking and smoking and crying a lot. So it was, to even get to the start line, I almost didn't make it from the start line. I almost ran away in transition because I was so scared, to actually make it to the finish. And I remember my ex-husband actually phoned my brother and handed me the phone, you know, just to say congratulations, which for me at that time, what we were going through was the most important thing. You know, finishing was great, but the fact that we were still talking and, you know, working together with the kids and stuff like that to make it through was really important. But yeah, it was just the most, that was like, that kind of opened up the door for me. I thought, okay, I've managed to somehow pull myself out of a kind of real low, a really tough time, and finish this somehow, you know. And that made me think, okay, so what else could I do, you know?
So your initial thought straight after you finished was like, okay, now what next?
Yeah, basically.
Well, you know, you asked the question and you found several answers. You know, your resume, especially in the world of swim, bike, run, you know, it's pretty extensive with full distance, you know, Ironman, iron distance triathlons, whatever you want to call them, double Ironman distance triathlon, triples, quins, deckers, you know, for people who are thinking these are just words, what are you even talking about? double distance Ironman, triple distance Ironman, five distance Ironman, 10 times distance Ironman. And then, you know, one of the things that I think is just fantastic, that's the only way that I can put it, in 2019 you became the first British person to finish people need to understand this because there's two different versions of this, a continuous double decker Ironman triathlon. And because, you know, I sort of live in this world as well, I appreciate that people can say, well, there's double decker Ironman triathlons, not buses, triathlons, where you will do a Ironman distance triathlon every day for 20 consecutive days.
Yeah.
So 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike and a marathon for 20 days straight. Now, don't get me wrong, that is extreme. That is an amazing achievement to do. But the big difference with what you did is a continuous. So you swam for 48 miles. And then when you finished, you got on your bike and you cycled 2,240 miles. And then when you finished that bike ride, you ran 20 straight marathons or 520 miles. Why? The first question is why did you want to, and I don't mean this sort of like off the cuff, oh, why would you want to do that? Because, you know, I've done some extreme stuff in my time as well. And I'm actually quite curious as to this answer is, why did you want to do a continuous double decker Ironman?
Right. I really struggle with the one a day because, as I'm always very upfront about, I'm not a particularly strong athlete. I'm not a natural athlete. I never did anything good at school. I hated sport. I don't have any natural ability. And I know some people say, oh, that's rubbish, but it's kind of true. Everything I do, obviously I train, but it's down to sort of determination. That's my strength, is being able to push through pain and being able to keep getting up. In terms of doing like fast Ironman, I'm known for not doing that very well. So I have tried to do the one a day deca and I have failed countless times. I will do it at some point. It's just I've got to pick the right time and I've got to be properly trained for it. I can't blag it because I run out of time basically. The closest I got, I've done a 5x Quinn. So I've done like 5 Ironman in 5 days and I did that really well. And I was on track to actually complete the one a day deca in New Orleans. And then we had an absolute shocker and it was like the most extreme weather they've had in 100 years. And I got to day 7 and we'd had so much drama. I won't go into, but it was just incredible. And it was more of a survival race at that point. And I got to day 7 and I'd run out of time. I was absolutely destroyed. You know, I'd reached that limit. So what's the continuous format is...
I just want to jump in there, Claire.
Yeah.
For say a deca, what is the cutoff time each day for the Iron Distance Triathlon?
It does depend on the race organisers. So some people in Switzerland, for example, have a 20-hour cutoff. So you've got to do each Ironman each day within that 20 hours for safety reasons. I run a deca and I do allow people this full 24 hours, but we monitor them. And if there are people that are struggling, we will, you know, pull them out the race ultimately. And it, you know, I know, like I said, personally it's horrendous and we will encourage people not to get to that point and we will help them all we can, but ultimately you get to a point where you're becoming a danger to yourself and everyone else, and you have to be aware of that. But yeah, so if you can do, you know, an Ironman within sort of 20 hours and you can continue on with that 4-hour break, then it's really hard, but,
fair enough, you know,
yeah. Yeah, so the continuous is naturally what I find works for me. It's still really difficult, obviously, but with my skills, my endurance and my determination, that works for me. And you've got a little bit more time and you can be a bit more flexible with what you do, your breaks and things like that. You're in more control, so you don't get to the end of day 3. And if you've had a massive punch, like, you know, a load of mechanicals, you've had loads of problems and basically you're out. With a continuous, you can go, okay, I had a bad day, but today is going to be better and you haven't been pulled from the race. So
is there a cutoff time for each discipline, say the swim, the cycle, and then the finishing line? Is there a cutoff time for each one?
Yeah, again, it's very dependent on the race organizer, but yeah, I mean, there will be cutoffs for each of them. I mean, the overall cutoff used to be 14 days. I made it 12 on, I think the one I did in Switzerland was 14. But I wanted to do it in 12. It was important to me. And I've made mine 12 days for Deca UK because I just think 14 is a bit much. We don't make it too easy, you know?
No, exactly. So for the continuous double Deca,
yeah.
Is there a cutoff for the entire event?
I think there was a 30-day cutoff.
Yeah. So if you're looking at it's the equivalent of 20 Ironman distance triathlons, so you've got a cutoff of 30 days. Like that's a whole month. Like that's
it's crazy. I remember saying to someone, I left in September and I didn't get back till November from Mexico. I missed out, and it was the most bizarre thing because I missed out the kind of autumn as such, and I kind of went back and it was winter, the dead of winter, and I just remember because I'd left in kind of late summer and I was super confused.
I bet you were. So I want to sit on the continuous double decker in Mexico that you did. And I actually followed you along. I don't think I reached out to and let you know, but I actually followed you along because I thought it was cool. Since we've connected, I think it was 2014 that we first connected when I came up to Snowdon and did the double brutal extreme triathlon, which we'll get onto in a bit. I followed your journey because you do some cool stuff that I think that's fun. So I followed you along in Mexico. And I've got a two-part question is, what was the most memorable thing of the race? And what was your most darkest moment?
Oh, God, there's a few dark moments. Memorable. That's a tricky one because there's so much. I mean, it'd be cliche to say finishing, and it probably wouldn't be finishing. I mean, I suppose the best part for me was the swim, because I didn't, it sounds awful, but I hadn't done a lot of structured training going into the event. Anyone who's read my book will understand that I was actually in a really dark place before. We'd had a few things go wrong that year. It'd been a very challenging year for me, very challenging, probably one of the worst years of my life, to be honest. And so I went into it in a bit of a state, I've got to be honest, mentally and physically. But the swim, I had some goals, quite clear goals. I wanted to really get on with it and not faff about. I wanted to have a good swim time, because I also was trying to show the race director of the Arche d'Arc. I was trying to get a place in the Arche d'Arc, and I thought if I do a good swim, it might be like, yeah, and I'm trying to impress him. So that was it as well. So, and actually I did very well with the swim. So for me, I kind of exceeded my own expectations. I think I was second overall. And I wasn't racing it. I was just really getting my head down. I didn't mess about. I was very, very focused on my stroke and being, you know, as streamlined as possible, and just trying not to get injured and things like that. And just really managing my time. A lot of people were getting in and out, having breaks and stuff like that. I did nothing. I was very disciplined. So I was very pleased, although I was in an absolute state when I got out. I was very pleased with that. So that, I would say that's probably the most positive thing to come out of that. The darkest point was when I started the run, and I was probably halfway through the run, and I got this injury on the front of my ankle. And at no point during the double decker did I ever think I wasn't going to finish. No point did I think I want to go home, I'm going to stop. I was just always like, as much pain as I was in, I was always like, I'm going to do this. Just that quiet kind of confidence. Sometimes you know, don't you? And you just, all I've got to do is suffer and I'll get to the end. When I got this injury, and it got worse and worse and worse to the point where I was just in bits, and there was a moment where I just thought, oh God, this could actually stop me. And it was a horrendous kind of, I've been here for weeks, you know, I'm scarred, I'm bloody, I'm broken, we've been through storms, everything. And I had this realization that shit, this might actually stop me. And that was a really horrible moment, you know. And then I remember like walking across this cobbled bit in transition and kind of twisting my ankle and going, oh my God, can it get any worse? Yeah, so that was pretty low.
So you've just walked into transition, you've walked over the cobbles, you've twisted your ankle again, that's already hurting. For the first time in weeks, you've said to yourself, actually, is this going to be a problem? You know, I've had this conversation with myself. It's like, yeah, this hurts and this is painful, but okay, whatever, just moving on. But there are times when you're like, actually, this is different. Mm. So yeah. You've hobbled in, rolled your ankle, twisted again on the cobbles into transition. Yeah. There's a little bit of doubt creeping into your mind. What is the conversation like in your head at this period of time?
I was pretty low, and I remember my friend Matthew Dowes, he was texting me, not a lot, but every now and again, and I told him, like, I was like, this is serious, this is not getting better, this is getting steadily worse and worse. And he just said, can you still walk? And I said, yeah. And he went, just keep putting one foot, and whilst you can keep putting one foot in front of the other, you're still in the race. And that was amazing, you know, that really changed my mindset. And also I thought, I kind of changed, I was like lying down in one of my little mini breaks eating pizza, and I just thought, what if I think, okay, maybe this could not get worse, this could get better. So I started trying to think, you know, power of positive thinking, whatever. I just thought, maybe this will get better. And I can't remember, maybe that was the Sunday. By Tuesday morning, it was noticeably improving. And considering during that time, I'm keeping the miles, you know, there wasn't any breaks, I was just keeping the miles going. And by Tuesday, it started becoming less painful. But it never went away, but I was able to finish the race, so.
Yeah, fantastic. So I want to back up a couple of days when you mentioned talking about going over to Mexico to do the continuous double decker, and you were in a pretty tough place in life. You were pretty low, and you weren't even sure if you were going to get to Mexico because of a lot of different reasons. From a mental perspective, how did you carry yourself and how did you get to the start line with all this other noise going on in the background of life?
To me, it was almost like an escape. Like we said earlier, that was purely, I know some people when they have a tough time, they might go for a holiday or something, but I guess for me, it was Mexico was, you know, in endurance stuff, it's about ultra endurance, all you can do is focus on that hour, sometimes that minute, that day, whatever. You can't, and I desperately needed a break from what was happening outside in my real life. And so to do this was almost like a holiday, if you like, really horrible holiday. But it was, I was caught in this little bubble. All I had to do is to keep swimming, keep cycling, keep running, and just focus on what am I eating next? You know, another punch, okay, deal with that. My blisters, bloody hell, they hurt. And, you know, so it was almost like, yeah, a break, that desperately needed break that I needed for, you know, so I could kind of get my head together, if you like.
I can completely relate to that. And something that I talk about with clients of mine, because I work with a lot of endurance athletes and ones who do other big ultra endurance challenges, and people who come to me about, well, I'm not sure if I can do an Ironman. I'm not sure if I can do a 100-mile ultra marathon. And one of the things I always say to them is, yes, you've got to do the training in the lead up to it, but that's the tough part. The fun part, the celebration, is the actual event itself, because during that day, during that week, or for you, during that entire month, there is nothing else that you have to be concerned about apart from swimming, cycling, eating, taking care of yourself, and so swimming, cycling, running, eating, taking care of yourself, and yeah, resting if you need. And I think a lot of people miss that when they look at these big challenges, and I'm not trying to sort of play them down, but what it is it is, I don't want to say an escape, it is a place where you can go and do nothing else apart from what you love doing. Yeah. And it sounds like you have that same experience.
Definitely. And I remember when I did the continuous Decker in Switzerland, there was a moment during the run, and I have this nerve problem with my feet, and I was in incredible pain at the time. And I remember just like walking around, it was in sort of early hours of the morning, and on the run course there's a section where you can just sort of see through the trees into basically the real world, which was like cars going to work, people going to work. And I remember just looking out there and just thinking, I'm gonna have to go, you know, a few days, I'm gonna finish this, and I will have to go back into the real world. And there was a part of me that's like, I need to appreciate this, because actually it's wonderfully selfish. You know, you're doing something incredibly hard, and yeah, I was in excruciating pain at that point, but there's the real world out there. And I'm like, I'm okay. I don't want to stay in this bubble for a little while.
Yeah. I'm going to share with you a little story that I know I haven't shared with you, but about your race, the Double Brutal Extreme Triathlon, and my experience, which was my first ever triathlon in 2014.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, with the propeller cap spinning and all the rest of it. People ask me about that, and it's still to this day, it is the funnest time I've had during a ultra endurance challenge, because I had a great time for the entire day and a half I was there. I had three close friends who were my crew. Yeah. We had great laugh. I just enjoyed the swim. I didn't want to get out. I wanted to keep going.
Wow.
Because I just got into this nice sort of flow state, saw the little, I called it the shipwreck, the little boat that's on the bottom of the lake turned upside down. And I love seeing that. And then coming out every three times to finish the eight laps, seeing my crew, that was great. And got on the bike, and it was a nice loop. And on the bike leg, you'll probably know exactly where this is just like before you come to the final climb, before you come down to Lembera, just before that, there's a smaller climb. And on the left-hand side, there's a venue. There's like an event venue.
Okay.
And during that race on the Saturday, there was a wedding there. And after I got on the bike and came around, I could see people were setting up. So every time I went past, people were setting up. The next time I went past, because we did eight laps for people for context of the double the 224-mile race, course, they were then setting up again and guests were arriving. And then the ceremony was happening. So every time I went past, just for a second.
Snapshot.
and I'm talking, you know, like 2 or 3 minutes as I just went on this small climb going past this venue. And it was sort of like a touch back into reality of like, oh, like people are doing real stuff this weekend.
People are doing other things.
And then as the afternoon went on and the party started and I saw dancing and the people were drinking. And then as the night went on, because I'm cycling into the middle of the night here, right? There were people out on the road who were absolutely hammered. Going, what are you doing on your bike? Give me a ride. Chasing up this climb. So I've been cycling for, you know, like 180 miles, 200 miles, and I've got these drunken people who have been at a wedding that I've been observing all day long chasing me up this climb. I'm like, dude, stop chasing me. I don't want to put any more effort in. I'm trying to tell him what I'm doing. So it was a snapshot every lap of what people were doing with their day. And it was a wedding. It was beautiful. It was great to see. But I can totally appreciate where you drop in and out of life of, and I'm using inverted sort of bunny rabbit ears with my fingers here, real life. But then you go back into what you enjoy doing. So I wanted to share with you that story of the double brew. And sort of with that in mind is, although you love going into this sort of endurance bubble where nothing else matters except for taking care of yourself and swimming, cycling, running, or doing whatever it is that you enjoy doing, what motivates you?
What motivates me? If I see something that I don't think I can do, I basically want to try and do it.
Why?
Because I don't think I'm attracted to the fact that one, I'm scared of it, or I you know, I just think it's for me, it's going to be really difficult. I mean, like the Arch to Arc that I'm training for at the moment, you know, it terrifies me, especially now I've got an actual date and things are actually really happening. I'm permanently, it's the only thing I think of. And I think, I know there's so many things I've got to go through to get to the point where I'm at the start line, and I'm relatively confident that I can give it my best shot. And it's that process, not overcoming the fears, but working with the fears and just doing my very best to kind of get to that point. If I know I can do something, I don't know, it just doesn't appeal to me. It's that, you know, I do continually set myself up with races that I go into, you know, and I think a lot of people would say as well, like the double decker, you know, I had a friend who didn't believe I could do it, just because, not in a horrible way, just because, you know, he knew what I'd been through that year, and I hadn't been trained properly, and he was just like, she's still doing the swim, oh, she's finished the swim, oh my god, you know. So there's a lot of things that I do that I know a lot of people don't think I can do, and it's true, you know. And I think that's what basically, you know, appeals to me.
So you talked about in your book your history, where you've come from, and, you know, you didn't really excel or really do sport or anything. But what you're telling me right there is you have this internal deep self-belief that, not to prove someone else wrong, but if there's something that you think, I can't do this, it almost attracts you. And there is self-belief, whether you acknowledge it or not, there is self-belief deep down inside of you. Where do you think that comes from, with now sharing with the world in your book all your deepest, darkest secrets of the past?
Yeah, there's like I know there's a part of me that I have some issues with my dad and stuff like that, and I think there's a part of me growing up as a, you know, young early teens where I just really wanted to impress my dad, and he, you know, he was busy with his own life and stuff like that, not to go into too much detail, but it ultimately I didn't really ever feel like I ever impressed him. And, you know, and I think it comes from there, if I'm being really, really honest. I think it comes, there's still a real sort of part of me that's trying to, yeah, That's pretty deep.
Yeah. So it sounds like that's a thread that you've only just sort of come to realize that maybe I should pull on that when I'm ready. But I want to say, like, that is a huge step forward to just acknowledging that. And also, you know, without going into any details, just sharing it with the world on a podcast. So I got a lot of respect for you. And I hope that you find a place in your life in the future where you can pull on that thread and let it lead you wherever it does. So thanks for sharing that. When you're at your happiest, and this can be in any context, and I'm probably going to guess where this is probably in your life, but when you are at your happiest, what's the conversation like in your head?
As in what?
When you're in a happy place.
Yeah.
You know, wherever that is, what's going on in your head when you're doing something that you love doing and you're extremely happy, or you're just in a moment where you're extremely happy? What's going on in your head?
I mean, like the other day I was out running, and it's been quite challenging to get any pleasure from running since I did the jog all, because I kind of really broke myself. I broke myself at the double decker, and then I did a whole bunch of other stuff. I just kept breaking myself until I was really to the point where running is where I kind of get my kind of pleasure from. I do like cycling and swimming, but it's running where I you know, get the most sort of enjoyment from, but it hasn't been enjoyable for a long time. The other day I was out running and I was actually kind of enjoying it, and I was on the coast path, and it was just like me, my music, and the views, which were limited because it's really foggy. But I think then it was just like, and you're just focusing on, you know, the moment at that point and appreciating, you know, what was going on. And also you get a real kind of, just a kind of clarity that all the problems that you may have worried about yesterday aren't actually that big, you know, and you can manage pretty much anything. You know, you just have to keep moving forwards.
Yeah, that's very eloquently put. And you mentioned the brutal joggle that you that you dubbed it, the self-supported solo 900 mile jog
adventure
with a baby stroller the length of the UK. I know, because it was and pun intended, it was a brutal challenge. Because I followed you along and I've read bits and pieces about it. I had several questions I wrote down that I was going to ask you, but I'm just going to get rid of them. I mean, I'm just going to ask a couple other ones that I've wanted to now after talking with you. Is why solo and self-supported? Because most of these other big races that you do, there is some sort of element of support. And it sounds like you like being around other people. You've got an events company, you know, so if you didn't like being around people, you wouldn't have started an events company. On one hand, you're doing these things with always having people around you to support you. And then all of a sudden you're like, you know what, I'm going to buy a baby pushchair pram thing and run 900 miles solo, self-supported. Why the solo self-supported?
I'm actually a really massive introvert. So I as much as I do like being around people, I also don't like being around people. So I do struggle sometimes. I mean, the events themselves, especially long events, I struggle with being around people for such long periods. So the juggle being self-supported, being on my own, didn't faze me one little bit. I've had a lot of time before where I've been on my own and I don't struggle with it. It's fine. What I actually was worried about was when people would come and they'd message me and meet me in places like that, and quite often I'd see people ahead and they've got a certain look about them, they're looking for you, and you're, oh no, because you're tired, and you thought, oh Christ. But actually what I found, what was the biggest revelation in that whole thing, was the people that met me gave me energy every single time, apart from one guy who was really annoying, but anyway, every other person, there was a lot of people, they just gave me an immense amount of energy, and you know, and biscuits as well, and crisps and stuff like that. But it was just they never overstayed their welcome either, apart from the one. And then they'd leave me and I'd be uplifted and just think, wow, God, I felt bad for, you know, seeing them and going, oh God. you know, and so for me, I kind of got into the routine. And so when I got down to kind of Cornwall, I think it kind of got a bit quieter, and I was actually missing my kind of daily, you know, sort of hourly dose of someone going, hi. And I was kind of a bit alone there. I was like, oh God, this sucks. So yeah, it was, yeah, it didn't bother me being alone, but actually, you know, the getting the energy from people and the encouragement and just their little, I get a break from my internal moaning, oh my feet, oh my God, and people would come in and talk about their lives a bit to me, and it would just transfer for me from another place and while away a nice hour or so. So that was good.
And what sort, because people will want to know, for it was about 900 miles that you completed, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What sort of mileage, like on average, obviously there's going to be days where you did a lot more and days where you did a lot less. Like what sort of mileage were you doing each day?
So I've got this problem where I massively overestimate what I can do. I do it all the time. I do it in my day-to-day life. I make a to-do list, which is so long. It's just like, for God's sake, woman, you know, it's just, so I would initially wanted to do 52 miles a day and then smash it out. And my mates were just like, Claire, for God's sake.
Self-supported.
Two marathons a day, knowing I'm not particularly good at it. I was just like, oh man. So I did the first day, 52 miles. And I was like, whew, Scotland, quite hilly. Found a little lay-by sort of field to sleep in. Again, first time I've ever wild camped as well. And it was, oh, it's like, wow. The next day I woke up and I was like, okay. Feeling it today, and just the DOMS and stuff from the uphill and the descents, which were very difficult with the baby jogger. Really, I didn't, because I hadn't trained with a baby jogger.
Oh, Claire.
It would have been useful if I'd have done some training. I ran up the road in my flip-flops when I bought it, so yeah, so that was day two. I was like, okay, there's quite a lot going on here that I wasn't prepared for, but I knew that was going to happen. And so, yeah, I basically then got to a point where I averaged around, it seemed to be around 37 miles a day. And that was the point where if I made 40, it was brilliant, but I was absolutely broken by 40. Like I was, like I said, I had this nerve pain thing with my feet, and I would get to the point that last 10 miles would be a complete battle of the, you know, my mental state. I'd be just crying and singing and muttering to myself because I was in so much pain. So,
yeah. And that, and people, like, we'll have runners and athletes and people who aren't runners or athletes listening to this podcast, and you're saying 3 miles, which is 5 kilometers, and it's like, okay, that is the difference between, you know, feeling good and finishing on a good day or having like a massive, like, smashed it day, but the last couple of miles are really tough. And people might be thinking, well, it's only like 3 miles, like, yeah, you know, weird. Just get on with it. But one of the things, and this is a completely anecdotal, this is completely just my opinion, is when you start doing continuous things days after days in an ultra sense, so, you know, when you're sort of talking around 30 miles a day,
yeah,
say, of running for this context, I explain to people every mile that you've got to run at the end, and at the end of the day, it's almost like running 5 miles.
Yeah.
At the start of the day or when you're fresh, because that 1 mile goes, okay, it's only 1 mile, it's only 1,609 meters, you know, to be exact. But when your whole body hurts from that day, when your whole body hurts from the previous days and weeks, it is a hell of a long way. And it's my rule of five that I keep in, that people try and ask me, what is it like? I was like, well, imagine you've only got 5 miles to go at the end of a marathon. And they're like, that is a long way. And it's like, yeah, that's what 1 mile feels at the end of these sort of days.
I had, when I was wild camping, sort of Scotland and further up the country, when it was easier just to nip into a field without getting in trouble, it was, I could pick and choose almost. But when it got to, occasionally I'd stay in like Premier Inns and stuff like that. So if I was booked into a Premier Inn in like built up areas, I would have to get to that point. So sometimes, you know, I had to do 42 miles that day. And those last, you know, absolutely, sometimes I would literally just collapse into the Premier Inn just in an absolute state and just be like crying basically in a big heap on the floor. So,
What's the weirdest thing that happened to you or that you did, if you want to divulge that information, during the brutal joggle?
The weirdest thing that happened was the farmer, And basically, so I was about sort of Bridgewater, Somerset Way. And it was one of the nights actually I was booked into a travel in, and I just couldn't make it. I had another 3 or 4 miles. It got dark. I was in bits. So I just thought, do you know what? I'm just going to find a place and pitch my tent and crash. And I found this kind of, because again, I'm in a town, it's quite difficult, but I managed just to find this sort of like driveway, which was led to a field. And I thought, oh, that'll do. No one will find me. It's pitch black. No one's going to interrupt me here. So I literally tent up, bang, straight to sleep. I got woken up by this like flashing torch in my tent. Someone shouting, get out, come on, get out now, come on. And it was a farmer, and he had like a crowbar. He had a crow, because that was the first thing I saw. I unzipped the tent and I just saw a crowbar in his hand. And I was like, oh shit, you've done it now. You all those warnings that your mum said about I was like, oh, it's actually happening. And he was really angry, and he was like, what are you doing here? And so after he was looking at the pushchair as well, like, you got a baby in there? And I was like, no. So I tried to explain what I was doing, and it took a few attempts for him to calm down, for me to stop shaking and speak properly. And I'd just woken up to explain what I was doing. And then he was like, oh my God, he was a really lovely guy, but he'd been broken into the night before. So he was high alert. I was off my face, and it was just such a, but by the end of it, we worked, and he was like, oh, can I help you? Do you want me to open the field? Do you want me to get some food? Can I give you a lift somewhere? And I was just like, can you just let me sleep? And he was like, yeah. So that was the weirdest thing. There was the other point where I slept in a school playground in a bike shed. That was really stupid. I went in there initially just to hide from the storm. And then I thought, oh, do you know what? This will be all right. And then I got locked in there. So I had to like climb over the fence the next day with the push. I had to put the pushchair over the fence and all my kit. Oh my God. And quite a lot of things happened, to be fair.
And did you do that before school started, or was school starting?
I think it was a weekend. So I think it was like the Friday night I went in there, but I did hear the lock go at some point. So I knew what I had coming. I was just like, oh God. Yeah. So
is this woman climbing over a fence with into a school?
Yeah. I had got up really early that day because I was just like, I cannot have the police being called, because it was like a little village and people would just look out their window and be like, what is she doing? And I was just like, threw everything over and just went off down the canal path, just going, oh God. There's a lot of crazy stuff. That one was, I wanted to do self-supported. To have the adventure experience, to have all that stuff that you don't expect. You can't prepare for a farmer and a crowbar. You can't prepare for half the stuff that happened. And I didn't want to either. I wanted to come across each thing and just overcome it, or, you know, get around it. And that's what I had to do. Like the wheel broke one day, just literally broke off and went off down the road on its own. And I just watched it and went, oh, shit. So it's overcoming all these obstacles. And that's what you don't get in a supported event. And yeah.
It's a double-sided coin, right?
Absolutely. But it makes a good book. Lots of tales and lots of excitement. But that was the one event that I knew would change me. And it definitely did. That changed me more than the double deck or anything else I've ever done, to be fair.
So I won't put a number on it, but what were some of the takeaways from the brutal joggle that you use in daily life?
The fact that I can survive anywhere, pretty much. Obviously, I've not done extreme stuff in different countries and stuff, but that's just because I've run out of money. I want to. But the fact that, you know, you can survive without people looking after you. You can do everything on your own. You can do so much more than you think you can. You know, you can get super low and pull yourself back up again. You know, I learned that I can endure a lot more than what I thought. And even though I'd done quite a lot at that point, it was still that being self-supported element that I hadn't really experienced. So that's what I've taken from it, that I, you know, if I was to break down somewhere now, it wouldn't faze me. You know, if I was in the middle of nowhere, I'd be like, okay, as long as I've got a decent amount of kit with me and I can stay warm and I can get some water, I'm fine, you know, which is, it gives you a great freedom, and especially as a woman as well, it gives you confidence.
Yeah, it's a massive thing, and as you sort of alluded to during your answer, is you can, that can translate into daily life outside of endurance stuff, and yeah. just to have that confidence to know that you are a strong, confident, and you know, empowering for yourself, human being, I'll say, to you know, if stuff goes wrong, then you know what, I can sort myself out here, because I've had these other experiences that have allowed me to grow as an individual. So one thing that I'm curious about, because I can completely relate to this, is writing your book, Becoming Brutal. What was the motivation to write your book and share in detail your true story, your past? So I get it. People have said to you, you've done loads of crazy adventures, you've done loads of cool things, you should write a book. And I had people say that to me all the time. But I'm not interested really sort of in that. As what I'm interested in is, what was your motivation to share in detail your deepest, darkest secrets, you know, in life?
I think I've always wanted to write a book even before I started doing all this stuff. So that's always been there for me. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. And so I was writing, you know, just over the last sort of 10 years, you know, the book kind of came from all of that stuff. You know, it took me quite a while to find all the bits I'd written and put, you know, in different folders on different places in the computer and stuff like that, to pull it all together. So it definitely wasn't like a thing that I did in 2 years. It was 10 years worth of work. But for me, when I started writing it, and it was a bit of a horrible realization, was the fact that if you're going to write a memoir type book, you've got to be honest, and you've got to be honest about the stuff that you aren't actually that confident, happy, comfortable with sharing. The drinking chapter for me is one I can't bear to even think about. I'm deeply embarrassed about it, but I had to write it, because what kind of person would I be if I gave like a half, you know, half truth, not sort of actually, you know, the real me? It just, for me, because I'm very all or nothing, I had to write the truth. And that book, apart from maybe one or two things that are very, very personal, involve other people, it's everything, you know, that's the whole truth. And that was a really important thing for me to do, but horrible as well, because once I'd published it, it was such hard work publishing it and actually getting it and getting it on Amazon as well. Afterwards, it was almost like when all the dust had settled, it was like, oh shit, what have I done? You know, I think I was just like wondering about like shopping or something, and I suddenly realized that everybody could read, like, and I know it sounds kind of stupid because I'd written it, you know. Oh God.
Yeah, no, I understand. I had the same thing. It was a case of, I had a writing coach, a good friend of mine, who I would basically, she didn't know that it's very similar to you. I've been writing for several years about my adventures. And then I had a really tough breakup, which I talk about in my book, Chasing Extreme. And I stopped writing for about 3 years. And then when my friend said, you should write a book about your adventures, and I was like, well, I'm going to send you something. And I sent her like 60,000 words that I'd already wrote. And she was like, this is really good. You just need to fill in these gaps here, and we'll add a little bit here, and you're good to go. And I'm like, yeah, that gap, there's a bit of stuff in there.
It's not like a happy place.
No. So because I've known her for a while and I trusted her, I said, look, whatever I send you goes in the book. And no matter what I say, if I send it to you, it goes in the book. So I went 100% all in, you know, by the sounds of it, for the majority of your life, you did as well. And I would send her even just an email that I write like a couple of paragraphs, or I'd write her updated version, and I would email her. And she lives in Australia. The amount of times that after I sent the email, I went onto Google to go, how do you unsend an email? Because I freaked out, because I had the same thought of you shopping. Yeah, yeah. Holy crap, people are going to read this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found out there is only one way that you can, and I'm using air quotes here, unsend an email. And this is the advice I kept getting, is you break into the person's house and delete the email from their inbox account before they read it.
It's true.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between your writing experience and my writing experience. Yeah. But the final thing I want to ask you about the book before we dive into what you've got coming up next, which you have mentioned in passing, is now that the book's been out for about 8 or 9 months, I think it is now. Is that right?
Yeah.
How do you view the experience from a personal perspective of writing the book and sharing your story with the world?
Initially difficult. I guess it's a bit like an event. It's a bit of a roller coaster. You know, that you get the initial, like I said, I mean, I'm the graphic designer, so I did all the everything, the design, the setting of it all. So it was, that was kind of almost what I do. So it was fine. And I got someone else to edit it, obviously. And, you know, it was, so that was just the kind of stuff that you went through. And that was quite methodical, and it was quite, you know, that was fine. And then I say it was quite challenging getting it on Amazon, because Amazon's just challenging to kind of, you know, get your head around, which I didn't know. It's not like putting something on eBay. There's lots more to it. And so that side of things was fine. And then the initial kind of, I suppose, rush of everyone buying it, and, you know, the initial feedback, which I was very nervous about. And that's all. But then it's kind of like that thing where you think, oh my God, what have I done? You know, it's all out there and stuff like that. That was really difficult. And then every now and again, I get a thing where I'm talking to someone and I mention something. They're like, oh yeah, well, I read that in your book. And you're like, oh God, I wrote a book. Oh my God, you know, you kind of forget about it initially, which is, and then sometimes I'll get a random Instagram message or email or something from someone just going, oh, I really related to that part, you know, the drinking or the abusiveness, you know, and all that. That's, and you think, I forget most of the time I've even written it. So it's like, oh wow, that's so awesome. And I had an email from a lady who had been affected by the same experience in the book, and she actually knew the person and blah blah blah, and that was amazing to get that. And she thanked me for actually writing it, and you know, we had shared a few tears really, because it was quite an emotional connection for me and for her. So great things have come from it, you know, really great things. And also, I mean, this is not a boast, I got longlisted for the William Hill. Yeah, I mean, what, for me, this is like, most of the time I think, is it really rubbish? And are my friends just going, yeah, it's great, Claire, and going, actually, it's just a bit shit, but don't tell her. So having a bunch of people who actually know what they're doing saying, this is okay, we're going to put it on that list. It's not the short list, but it's the long list. But I'm like, oh my God, that, so I can write, okay.
Yeah, it's for sports books. It's the biggest literary award, from my knowledge, in the UK, the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Awards.
Yeah.
And they have a long list and then a short list and then a winner. Yeah. And
I didn't know a long list existed, actually, but I do now.
it makes sense. It makes sense.
Yeah, so, it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was for me. I didn't believe, I thought a lot of people were just being nice and saying it was all right. So to have a bunch of people that I don't even know that read, like, you know, 150 books and gone, yeah, this one's okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that was really exactly my confidence. Yeah.
Your friends and your mum will always be your fans. But when
my mum hasn't read it, my mum won't read it. She's like, Claire, we've lived through this every minute. We don't need to read one.
That's fair enough. So yeah. Becoming Brutal is on Amazon. Go and check it out. Claire Smith is the author. It is a great read, and it's an emotional roller coaster, but at the same time, it's hard to not read it and come away with some thoughts, some guidelines, even for your own life, to stop and reflect and help you in your own, to navigate your own journey. So I want to say, from me personally, Claire, I want to say thank you for being so open and honest in writing Becoming Brutal.
Cool, thank you. Yeah.
And the last thing I want to talk about today is what's next. So you've mentioned it. I'm going to build it up. The Arch to Arc Triathlon. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, it is quite literally going from London to Paris via running, swimming, and cycling. So 87 miles from central London down to Marble Arch, which is in central London at the west side of Oxford Street, for those who don't know London that well. Run down to Dover, through or to Folkestone, sorry, and then swim across Dodoba, swim across the English Channel. The English Channel swim is very, very famous, brutal swim, and then cycle the 181 miles from Calais to the Arc de Triomphe in the center of Paris. I know you've alluded that open water swimming scares the bejeebers out of you, especially, you know, channel swimming.
God.
Are you excited?
Yes, and terrified mainly. I mean, this has been like a thing. So when I did my first double Ironman, which was the first double Ironman that had ever been held in the UK, it was put on by Enduroman, who organised the Arc to Arc, and I met the race directors there, and I was like, oh, you know, I've done the double, what's next sort of thing. And it just was like, the Arc to Arc. I'd known about it, but I definitely hadn't thought for a second, you know, no, that's not for me. When I did the double, afterwards, I started getting to know the race directors, and there was a part of me that just started going, actually. And then before you knew it, I was on the list. As my book probably explains, is that there was a lot of, you know, turn and fro in and ups and downs. And I just haven't been able to get to the point where I've been able to do it. I haven't been trained enough. I've run out of money. There's all sorts of things that have stopped me. My swimming's just never been strong enough. I know Eddie, who's the first guy to have ever, he's the founder of the race. And he's become a friend over the years as well. And he's also just not been prepared to put me in the water because he just doesn't think I can do it, you know. And he's bloody honest as well, which is like, it's great, but it's sometimes it's not. If Eddie says something, you know, it's like, if he says well done, no, but if he did, yeah. And he's just saying, Claire, you're not good enough. So to be on the start list now and to have a place is so exciting, but at the same time, it's that I can't blag this in any way, shape or form. And I know there's a tendency for me to try and blag some things sometimes, not arrogantly, it's just I've always got too much going on, and yeah, I don't get my training done. But with the Arc to Arc, I have to get my training done. So
that's it, because bottom line, this is a big swim. And the swim can literally break it. You can't just sort of say, you know, the run is 87 miles. Well, if your legs get sore down in the rolling hills of Kent, I'm just going to have a little walk, or I'm just going to stop for 5 minutes, which you can do on a run. You can do that on the bike. Swim in the English Channel.
You can't stop for a second. You might go backwards.
Yeah. My wife has swum the English Channel as a relay and solo. So I've heard plenty of stories from her, plus other friends who have done it. There could be times where you're swimming, not going anywhere for an hour, and you're just being told, don't slow down. You have to keep swimming because the tide will turn. So there is no rest.
It's so complicated. Yeah. There's so much more to it. Unless you're in that channel swimming world, you don't really understand. And I've crewed on a couple now, and I know a lot of people who have done that, and also from the Arc to Arc perspective as well, you're very tired from the swim up on the run rather, so you've got that fatigue, and quite often us triathletes are a bit skinny, so that's another thing, so you know, it doesn't help having low body weight with this at all. So it's like, I wrote a list the other day, what's going to stop me, you know, and it is basically from getting too cold, from not being fast enough, and basically my head if I have massive panic attacks. And it's like, right, they're the three things that can stop me. Something also, number four, the thing out of control, that's out of my control, so I can't, you know, shelf that. But the other things is like, you can put on a little bit of weight, so that's okay, you know, you just got to get your training in the pool, you've got to be getting the weights out, you've got to get into the sea and stuff like that. And then the acclimatization, you've got to be doing that. So next Thursday, I'm going to Lanzarote basically for a swim camp, where I will spend a really long time in the sea. I spoke to Eddie yesterday and I was like, oh, this time next week will be warm. He went, yeah, but you won't be. I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've been to Lanzarote in January, and swimming for a couple of hours in the ocean, it's not warm.
No, it's not going to be warm. It's great training though, and I need to be building up from, you know, I'll be doing anything from 2 to 10 hour swims there, so that'll be fun.
the 24th of September until the 4th of October, I will be following a dot online, watching you take on the arch to arc, Claire. And it's been my extreme pleasure to have you on the Luke's Lowdown podcast. Thank you very much. And I've got one final question. If there is a listener sitting here, hearing all of your stories, hearing parts of your journey and enjoying this podcast, and they have a big challenge, whether it's physical, whether it's from a business perspective, or whether it's just in life in general, if they've got something really big in front of them that scares the living daylights out of them, and they were standing in front of you right now, what would you say to them?
Other than obviously do it, because that's why I always do that, because I'm just the worst person to come to for that advice. Do it, but break it down. You know, just I always break everything down. Anything, you can achieve anything if you break it down. And if you break it down and it still scares you, break it down further, and then just keep doing that until you can crack on.
Love it. Thanks very much, Claire. And remember, everyone, share the Luke's Lowdown podcast with your friends, your community. It's been great to have another inspiring guest on here. And remember, say hi to your mum for me. Bye now.